The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Tom Clark, and this is Politics Weekly.
This morning, the Justice Secretary was on the radio suggesting that there were serious rapes and other categories of rapes. Would the Prime Minister now like to take this opportunity to distance himself from the Justice Secretary's comments?
The Cabinet's biggest beast joins the growing list of the ministerial walking wounded as Ken Clark faces calls to resign. Also this week...
I don't think it can conceivably be described as a private preoccupation for one politician or another. This is something as a country we've been debating for over a century.
Meanwhile, Nick Clegg joins an even longer list of parliamentarians who've tried to reform the Lords. Will his attempt bring us any closer to a democratic chamber? And with 24-hour rolling news, Twitter, live blogs and, yes, podcasts, as well as print deadlines, are we all too frenzied to talk sense anymore? And can anybody be a political journalist these days? Joining us in the pod, we have our good friend from Mashires, the writer and historian Anne Perkins. We have the journalist, author and former secretary to John Major, Sheila Gunn. And down the line from Westminster, our columnist, blogger, podcaster and tweeter, Michael White. A warm welcome to you all. Well, we'll come back to political journalism at the end of the show, but it was something that Ken Clark will have had his fill of after looking at this morning's papers. He pitched up at BBC Radio 5 Live this week to explain a plan to give further reductions in sentences to offenders who plead guilty in a trial. It was a proposal that was seized on by that morning's tabloids as meaning that rapists could get out after barely a year in prison.
A year and a bit?
Yes, a rapist gets 5 years.
Rapists get more than that.
5 years on average. Yes, they do, Mr. Clark. Yes, they do.
That includes date rapes, 18-year-olds with having intercourse with 15-year-olds.
So if they plead guilty early, that is taken down to 2.5. They're released after half their sentence. That's the norm. That's pretty much automatic. So that takes it down to just over a year.
No, serious rape, I don't think many judges give 5 years for a forcible rape, frankly. The tariff is longer than that.
Ken Clark on the BBC's Victoria Derbyshire programme there. Anne Perkins, if there was one particularly clanging word there, it was serious with regard to rape.
It's classic Ken Clark, isn't it? Kind of strolling into a minefield without kind of even trying to find a think his way through it because he's so used to being able to think on his feet. It was a colossal misspeak that addresses a much bigger truth about, you know, at its grandest, you might call power relations in society. But he didn't mean it. And I think Labour and, to some extent, the Sisterhood have got this wrong.
Really? I mean, he's the man in charge, though, isn't he, of justice policy? And if he's sort of suggesting that some rapes aren't forcible, aren't people entitled to think then it's not arriving on his desk and being treated with the seriousness that it should be?
I don't think for a moment that's what he meant to say.
One of Ken's problems, I felt yesterday, was he was also trying to explain that actually you can be accused of rape when actually you've engaged in consensual sex, which is actually, say, with a 15-year-old girl, which is the example he went and gave in that interview, that someone actually is accused and prosecuted and can be convicted of rape, an 18-year-old man having consensual sex with a 15-year-old.
Well, some people, is that definitely right for 15?
Absolutely. It's true, apparently, because
well,
I looked it up.
Because if you're under 16, you're not entitled to consent.
So it's rape.
So technically it's rape.
But he was sounding like a lawyer.
Yes.
Which, of course, is what he is. And Ken, of all people, well, you know, I'm one of his greatest fans, but one despairs of Ken sometimes. He should have, he'd obviously got a bit tetchy. The interview wasn't going the way he wanted. He was getting quite annoyed, I think, with Victoria. And he really did, I mean, there's a saying in when I was working for John Major in particular, saying, if you're on a hole, stop digging. Mm. And all Ken did yesterday was just digging himself, as far as I could see, deeper and deeper.
It's his phrase, that, wasn't it? If I remember right. I think it was Ken Clark's own phrase. Sounds like him. Anyway, Michael White, Tory right wing never liked him much, did they? And now he's annoyed a lot of liberals too. Is he running out of allies?
No, I have more confidence in the British public than to suggest Ken Clark will ever run out of allies. And I listen to my colleagues, good people, struggling here to say exactly what Ken Clark said wrong and why he's kind of wrong, but not. I'm terrified to open my mouth on this one because, as Anne Perkins said so eloquently a moment ago, the power relations in our society are changing so rapidly that almost anything I say will be misinterpreted in terms of gender politics. I'm not being facetious here. I thought, and not for the first time in this situation, that Clark was saying that, as in most offences, motive, consequences, context, a matter. We don't just say murder is always murder. You know, we know that. There was a time when a battered wife who finally turned and knifed her brutal husband was convicted of murder, probably hanged in the good old days, as we ironically call them. We don't do that anymore. And all Clark was trying to say, provoked by Victoria Derbyshire, was, come on, you know, there is context and circumstances. Sheila Gunn just mentioned one. But I find the way in which this is discussed depressing, not for the first time. And also, I can't help adding, across the channel, people yep. much like us in terms of outlook, experience, culture, history and DNA are saying, hey, this fellow we thought was going to be our next president, accused of attempted rape in very serious circumstances in New York, it's a setup. He didn't do it. 57% in a poll. The contrast between the public debate and context is astonishing.
What I was kind of floundering towards trying to say is there are a lot of serious problems about bringing rape trials to court. And there is a very serious problem, which didn't begin to be reflected in yesterday's debate, about, in particular, I mean, it's true of all criminal trials, but it's particularly true of rape trials, where they're very hard to get to court. And when they get to court, then the accused attacker pleads guilty at the gate on the first day of the trial.
And sorry, we'd rather they didn't?
No. Because they have taken the calculated risk throughout the preparation for the trial that at some point the Crown Prosecution Service will say there isn't enough evidence and they would never be brought to trial at all.
But that is not peculiar to rape cases.
It's
Anne.
Not peculiar
not
to rape.
Not at all.
No, it's not. It is not peculiar to rape cases. But rape cases are notoriously difficult to gather the evidence
yeah.
for all sorts of reasons, which include women not being believed and women being very reluctant to come forward. And that's why it is such a difficult subject to talk about, and it's why Ken Clark should have thought a lot harder before he went into a radio studio.
It is also different, surely. It is also why rape is different in another context as well, is the figure which I felt Ken should have made much more of, and so should Cameron, is the fact that only 6% of rapes reported in a police station actually end up with a conviction at the end of it. Mm-hmm. And this is after you had a new Labour government, Labour governments who kept on about how tough they were going to be on this offence, how, you know, it was in the same category as murder, and that this has happened.
Which, of course, is nonsense with respect. And it's annoying to hear it. Of course, Labour government tried to do it. And the reason they failed is because it's difficult. But the reason it's very difficult isn't just because all men are bastards, or as extreme feminists would say, all men are rapists, would-be rapists. You know, it's a lot of freight, to use Anne's phrase, involved in this one. And it's not simply the failures of the law or failures of investigation or failures of imagination by society. I'm not going to go into this. I'm terrified to say any more.
But it is true,
because I'll
Mike.
Get into trouble.
But it is true, Mike, that there is a very long history of men in general and women assuming that women are in some way to blame for being raped, you know,
yep.
whether it's the length of their skirt or the, you know, sauciness of their walk.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to take the Fifth Amendment on that one.
Sheila.
This is such a... I can see why Michael is so hesitant to get too involved in sort of this debate. But the one thing I think you can say about Ken Clark, the one motive that I think drove everything he was saying
yeah.
is he wants more rapists convicted and locked
yeah.
up.
But he should have explained it like that, shouldn't he?
I mean, he should have done. So I don't know who on earth is advising him on the press side at all.
No,
I have not, for my experience. He never actually quite listened to any advice anyway. But he wants more rapists locked up. So I didn't quite see why he didn't come out and say that.
I think he wants people to spend less time in prison. And I think that was actually why he was on.
Yeah, let's hang on to that point, shall we?
That was why it was a difficult interview to start with.
I mean, my feeling is that what he wants is to balance his department's budgets. He's quite relaxed about the fact that we'll mean fewer people in prison overall, but surely...
I think actually that's cynical, Tom. I think he genuinely does not believe, and it's a very important change in Conservative policy, he does not believe the Michael Howard mantra that prison works.
No, sure, exactly. And so
that's why the Tory tabs hate him, incidentally. That's why the Mail and the Sun are gunning for him. The Sun says, what a disgrace he is to British womenhood today. The Sun! Pass the sick bag, Alice.
But Sheila, what I'm interested in, I mean, you're a former spin doctor, if I can put it like that. He'd got this argument. It's partly about, his liberal instincts. It's partly about his desire to, like, make the books add up. But he's got a policy here that he could defend by saying the problem is that we've got too low a conviction rates. Yes. If we were more pragmatic about how to go about this, we'd have got more. Why didn't he go out and say that?
I'm not quite sure. I mean, he just got himself into deeper water. I mean, if you look at it from the point of view of a victim, surely it is better that rather than have the rapist walking out there in the street, to at least actually have some sort of jail sentence.
Yeah.
And admit...
And be said that they're guilty.
Yep. I mean, the worst scenario must be those poor women who go to court, go through all the trauma of court, and then there isn't enough evidence and the case collapses. I mean, that must be, you know, it's an unimaginable nightmare, that.
And can I just ask you finally, Sheila, what did you make of the... I mean, obviously, the pre-spin on this was an absolute disaster. What did you make of the rescue operation? You've done a few of those in your time.
Yes, crisis management, I think it's called. I was quite surprised that Cameron wasn't briefed before question time or warned. But, of course, that might have been a tactical decision to think, my God, if we tell him about this before, he cannot, in all honesty, then stand up in the House and say, actually, I haven't listened to this interview. So that if that was what the tactics were, they were quite cleverly sort of done. It did take a bit of time. I wasn't too sure if it was totally joined up. They obviously sent Ken out, probably... to go and try and correct everything. But I'm not sure if he quite absorbed all the briefing he was then given.
He's an honest man.
Absolutely.
That's Ken Clark's crime.
Yep, absolutely. Yes, I think Michael and I very much agree on that. And Anne as well.
Not for the first time, Ken Clark hasn't quite digested all his briefing in the way he was meant to. But from one slightly old-fashioned and wise Westminster institution to the House of Lords. Now, old hands like Ken... might one day have expected that defenestration would have been followed after a discreet interval by elevation. Not, however, anymore if Nick Clegg gets his way.
There's a very simple principle at stake. Do we believe, yes or no, that it is a good thing in a democracy that people should be able to hold those who make the laws of the land directly to account? Yeah. All of us, according to our manifestos, believe that is the right principle. I think, therefore, it is right for this government to try, on a consensual, open and pragmatic basis, to try and reach agreement so that we can finally put that principle into practice.
Yeah. Anne, you're a historian. Weren't people saying pretty much exactly the same 100 years ago?
If it was easy, it would have been done a long time ago, wouldn't it? And yes, they have been trying to do something for a long time. It's very hard to prise their fingers off those lovely red plush chairs and the bars and the view of the river and that wonderful sense of entitlement. And I think that Mr. Clegg is going to have a very, very tough battle to get this one through too.
And Mike, there's an irony here, isn't there? Because although it's not for the Liberal Democrats, because although, of course, the House of Lords isn't democratic, it has been the most doggedly or muscularly liberal part of Parliament in the moment on the Police Act and in forcing through the changes the Lib Dems want on health and all the rest of it.
Well, you used the phrase a moment ago, Tom, if Nick Clegg gets his way. And I thought that was a kind of rhetorical flourish which answers itself. Anne's right, of course, this ain't going anywhere. And it ain't going anywhere in part because, as she also said, it's very difficult. Democratic and liberal. Well, you see, you're posing two contradictory propositions there. The AV vote the other day reminded the Progressive majority that it's actually quite a small majority and that I sometimes think we talk too much about testing things as to whether or not they're democratic. I'm much more interested in the other half of the equation, which is accountability, and was very struck during Nick Clegg's Commons performance in the week. He was, incidentally, much more conciliatory. He didn't say Labour completely failed on Lords reform. Actually, Labour did more to reform the House of Lords than any government in the last 100 years. He said But he acknowledged that they'd done stuff. But he talked about democracy and accountability. Sure, we believe in that. And somebody got up and said, you're proposing that peers, senators, whatever we're going to call them, get elected for 15 years and then are never allowed to stand for election again. Remind me, I can see that's democratic, but where's the accountability in that?
Sheila, David Cameron, I think it was his phrase, is a kind of typical public school nonchalant, says this was a third term priority, meaning it's not a priority at all. And Nick Clegg's problem now, isn't it, is that if this is going to go through, it needs the Prime Minister to pull out his finger and use the Parliament Act.
Yes, he has got a problem with this. One of my very few claims to fame is I was the first dedicated House of Lords correspondent. It was actually for The Times in the 1980s when the Lords, House of Lords, is one of the few places where there was real opposition to some of Margaret Thatcher's reforms. And Michael might have been thinking about the, I'm sure this is in his thoughts a lot, is the 1911 Parliament Act. But actually, you should remember there was, of course, Harold Macmillan, who brought in the Life Peerages Act that actually changed the character of the House of Lords a lot.
Yeah, that's now, a fair point. 1911 is more important, but you make a good point.
Yep. 1911 was a crucial one, as we both know.
And they beat them down. And they beat them down on Lloyd George's budget, the most radical budget of the 20th century. That's absolutely the most important thing. And the Lords were forced to blink.
Now, I'd like to propose a new law. And my new law, the first thing that should be done, and Clegg and Cameron should take this on board, and actually even Miliband, is to stop anyone who has ever served in the House of Commons ever sitting in the House of Lords.
Well, that really would change it, wouldn't
it? You bring it in now, quickly, because that, actually, the factor that people who've been MPs, been ministers, they always hold out this hope that one day they'll go onto those red benches that Anne talked about. And it's kept 5 degrees warmer than the House of Commons. You've got all those nice bars.
That's
you've got
quite
the choice.
Right, too. 5 degrees warmer. Yes. Somebody's got to stand up for the old people in this podcast.
Absolutely. I mean, in fact, there's a good argument for replicating the House of Lords throughout the country. It is the most brilliant place.
Cross care homes. That's the answer.
Absolutely. It is the most brilliant place for older people to go. Whenever I take students in there, they're convinced that some of them have died. I have to explain that the reason peers are lying back with their eyes closed is because they're listening to the microphones which are in the back of the benches. And my American students.
Disappointing.
I was in there once when someone did die, I have to say. But luckily, a doorman did notice after half an hour or so. But you have so many, the 80s and the 90s, and even you've had a couple have touched on 100. And so it's the most perfect forum, I think, for discussion from that point of view. It doesn't do much harm either.
But it does quite a lot at the moment, doesn't it? I mean, these changes from this ermine-trimmed retirement home you're talking about, the changes that are coming through to the health bill, the Liberal Democrats like to think this is due to the democratic decision-making of their spring conference.
Yes.
But really, it was the fact that all these, admittedly, on average, quite old people were going to make a big fuss and not put up with it.
Yes, absolutely. The same with the police commissioners.
Yeah.
The elected police commissioners as well.
But you're in favour of that, Tom. You just said so.
I'll be like Jeremy Paxman now and say, I ask the questions, Mike.
But there is this big issue. You know, what Nick Clegg really hasn't talked about is actually what this Senate would actually do. He doesn't seem to have looked at that particularly.
No.
Well, that's because he doesn't want to go there, because that's a whole new terrifying avenue of exploration. And it's much easier and safer, and indeed it's what everybody wants, to say it is simply going to go on doing what it does now,
yeah,
which is to revise.
Except,
which is,
of course, it won't, because it'll expand its powers just like the Supreme Court.
As it already has, since it gained slightly greater legitimacy, you know, since the Labour reforms.
But hold on, we're all starting to kind of apologise for them and talk about it. But there are, let's not forget, Anne, still a small host of people in there who are there purely because of who their father was and purely because they are high up in one religion rather than another religion. It's an abomination, isn't it?
No.
No.
Come on, Mike.
No, I've said enough.
And if you sat there with a blank bit of paper, you would certainly not have the House of Lords the way you have it now. You wouldn't have the monarchy the way it is now. But let's face it, they both work. And actually, the monarchy and the House of Lords, of course, do have quite a strong connection. I've been reading the obituaries.
Not anymore.
No, I've read the obituaries of the Earl of Onslow, Michael Onslow.
Oh, yeah.
Who is one of those.
73, died this week.
Absolutely. Wonderful old character, who actually, I think, contributed quite a lot, you know, to public life in the way he tried to improve bills and to question government policy and things like that. Now, you wouldn't actually have a second chamber designed with people like Michael Onslow and if you're starting from scratch. But if you do have a democratically legitimate second chamber. I still can't get over this problem, which was once raised by Enoch Powell and Michael Foote, both in together, about who
they was ruined Lord's Supreme. Reform between them in 1968. Let's not forget that. The lefty yes, and the righty.
Exactly, yes. They got together. It'll be interesting to see what happens this time.
Yes, it will.
Michael White, the talking footnote.
Now,
there are worse fates.
Enough about them, the politicians. What about us, the journalists? Sorry, we can be a bit self-centred, but as you're listening, you're no doubt aware that the media these days comes in all sorts of new packages like podcasts. But, Mike, you know, you're an enthusiastic tweeter and blogger and all the rest of it.
I wouldn't go quite that far, but I certainly do.
You are a tweeter, a blogger and all the rest of it. Amid all the deadlines, self-imposed and otherwise, that you work to, do you think ever that something's got lost in the mix?
Oh, yeah. No time to think, no time to talk, no time to reflect. Very little time even to report and get out there and talk to people because you're too busy tweeting, blogging, podcasting. I am, at the moment, also sketch writing. I'm watching the television with the sound turned down. And I've taken a call from the Paris correspondent while we've been on air here. And I've done a blog. And we're all on the hamster wheel. And it's mad. And it's fairly pointless because, rather like ever more supermarkets, there's only a limited amount of time and money people have to go shopping. There's only a limited amount of time. It's a shocking thing to say to journalists that people have to absorb the vast overproduction of media. It's a bit like Soviet steel production. You produce it, but who's going to buy it?
That's
the great
thought.
Problem for our industry today. Who's buying it? There's an over capacity, an oversupply, and there are not enough people willing to pay for it.
I just wonder, Mike, you make that point about the kind of continual reporting of the superficial stuff and the lack of reflection and the lack of conversations. Do you think that means, or perhaps I should ask Sheila, or perhaps I shouldn't be asking the question at all, but
asked the question.
Yeah, Tom asked the questions, I know. Tom, will you ask?
Go on, ask us a question.
Whether this actually has an impact on the way politicians do their business, because they know that it's, they're not going to be pursued in depth on the substance of their policy or not the way they perhaps might once have been, both in the Commons Lords and in the television studio and so on.
It's an interesting point. I wouldn't want to be entirely negative about the sort of plethora of new media. The terrific thing about the internet and other forms of social and other news media is the extent to which you really can get detail. You really can read Nick Clegg's statement on Lords Reform if you want to, almost in real time. All the speeches are up online. You can access the bills. You can access the Hansard.
And
it's so can
wonderful. People who know what they really mean,
yeah,
which is
that's
another
right.
great sort
yeah,
of...
Yeah, that's right.
Concept.
But, of course, it's this another aspect of the problem. People who are information rich and poor, and it creates a kind of information elite, a bit like investment bankers, who've got 10, instead of 10 times as much more information as the average voter, they've got 100, 200. Their capacity to absorb it is enormous. So it's a good thing, but it opens up the democracy gap, if you want to use that overworked word, worse than it existed before. And
I always have the worry, though, with it, Sheila, that it's a bit like candy floss whipped up to be very big out of a small amount of sugar. And I had this feeling the other day. I found myself for the first time in my life on the front page of the BBC website saying The Guardian's Tom Clark has tweeted, and I'd tweeted something that I'd watched on BBC television, and I thought, this is a weird hall of mirrors here.
Yes, I absolutely agree with everything Michael has said about how the pressures on political journalists have changed. But one reason why I wrote the book, So You Want to Be a Political Journalist, is the fact that I'm worried when I'm teaching my students that they're coming into this thinking that they're going to be standing there in front of the door of number 10 and their views on what's happening in politics is going to be terribly important. And they don't quite understand the grind still of their everyday life. And which is why I always say to them, which puts off quite a lot of people from journalism per se, I think, is first of all, go along to a council meeting, go along, say, to a planning committee meeting or licensing committee meeting at the council, go and sit in a select committee hearing in the House of Commons. Both things you can do as members of the public, you can listen to them, and see if you can find stories from that. And if you can't actually, if you start to panic after about 10 minutes, because first of all, you don't understand what people are saying, you don't know who's who, you find it unbelievably boring, the mm-hmm. idea of having to sit through these meetings. And still, Michael, you do have to sit through a fair amount. You think of party conferences, you have to sit through a fair amount of this stuff, don't you? To then
it's actually... no worse than reading the thread on a podcast or a blog.
No, there's always a
nugget of great stuff in a thread, but most of it is just abuse or stupidity or both. They'll love that, won't they?
But I mean, so obviously you're saying you get out there, Sheila, and look at a meeting, and if you don't find it's your thing, then it's not for you.
The first job, when I went to journalism college in Cardiff, the first thing we did, and we actually did this at City University, I'm not sure if it's still done, in London, is we send potential students out into the street and say, come back in an hour and a half. And I was told to find 10 ideas for stories and to write down my ideas for stories from just literally going out and just looking around me. And it soon separated the men from the boys, as they say, because some people thought this wasn't what they thought journalism was about, but exactly how you look at the world.
And, I mean, is your feeling that with all this media, we've been talking about the problems here in terms of lack of reflection and so on, but, you know, your book, so you want to be a political journalist, obviously aimed at people who want to get in. Do you think all the Twitter and the rest of it means that there is now an open door, or do you think that placements and work experience and everything that are available to people whose parents can keep them in board and lodgings while they do are still...
Oh, dear. Shall I make an admission, Tom? There's someone called Alan Rushbridger.
Yeah.
Who actually was attached to me on work experience back on the Surrey Daily Advertiser quite a few years ago. And look what happened to him.
Investigation.
And I took him to magistrate's court. And I suppose I wasn't too sure how good a journalist he was going to make at that point, because instead of just writing up, you know, the speeding and the drunk drivers and all the rest, he wanted to question, you know, what went on in court. He wanted to analyse, you know, the fact that, well, you know, it all seems so fast and so straightforward, you know, no room for grey areas and things like that. So I thought he'd probably end up as a leader writer instead. But the one thing that does worry me, and actually the Independent's partly to blame for this, but new technology's taking it a step further, is all journalists now seem to be commentators as well. There used to be this thing about reporting facts and news.
Comment is free, but facts are expensive.
I actually don't think you can be a good journalist, a good reporter, unless you've got a very thorough understanding of the significance of what you're reporting.
Oh, steady
so,
on that.
So I mean, you journalists have always been commentators. The selection of facts has always illustrated, you know, what you think about the story.
But that's within a different discipline framework, Anne.
Yes, it's a way it's changed a bit. It's the things that Michael mentioned, the fact instead of going and getting all three or four stories and reporting them, you know, I used to get my select committee reports, sit on the terrace of the House of Commons in the morning, have my coffee, gut them, write them up over lunchtime, and that's story done. Nowadays, you know, the demands of, you know, there's Michael is going to have tweet this, blog that, take these calls from all over the place. The pressures have changed, I think, considerably.
Okay, final word to you, Anne.
Final word. I quite agree that the pressures have changed, but it seems to me that makes it even more important that you know what you think about the story or the stories that are likely to come across your desk that day, you know, at the start of the day. And as Hugh Edwards once said to me, you know, I decide what I think at 9 o'clock, and I don't change my opinion unless something comes and hits me between the eyes. And the truth is, you do need to have that very strong sense of where stories are likely to go during the day, whether they actually conform to the pattern or whether they're going to deviate.
It's called judgment, and that's something Michael White has in abundance.
Yeah, well, but it's very underestimated in modern journalism. You take it from me. I get persecuted for getting things right all the time.
Well, there we are. We're going to have to leave it. I'm sorry that Anne didn't get the last word, but to her nonetheless, and to Sheila Gunn and Michael White. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.